WHYY is proudly supported by Penn Medicine. From groundbreaking discoveries to life-saving care, Penn Medicine's innovation is helping to change lives, one moment, one treatment, one patient at a time.
This is Fresh Air. I'm Terry Gross. The new film Bugsy was written by my guest, James Toback. Bugsy is about Ben Bugsy Siegel, the gangster who virtually invented Las Vegas when he came up with the idea of building a palatial gambling casino in the middle of the Nevada desert. Bugsy is played by Warren Beatty. Annette Bening plays Virginia Hill, the starlet he falls in love with. This is the scene in which they meet. Bugsy is trying to pick up Virginia. He's just found out she's involved with another gangster. She's just found out Bugsy's married to a woman named Esther.
Now, what exactly does Mr. Esther want from Miss Virginia?
Right now, Mr. Esther is having a tremendous amount of difficulty imagining anything he doesn't want from Miss Virginia.
Oh, I bet he could pull a rabbit out of his hat if he really tried.
Yeah.
Are you ready for a divorce, Mr. Siegel?
Never.
Wow. My, oh, my, you're pretty ferocious where Mom's concerned, aren't you?
Yeah.
The rest of the time, you're just another good-looking, sweet-talking, charm-oozing fellow with nothing to offer but some dialogue. Why don't you run outside and jerk yourself a soda?
Dialogue written by my guest James Toback. Toback also wrote the screenplay for The Gambler, and he wrote and directed Fingers, Love and Money, Exposed, and The Pickup Artist. Toback says his involvement with the film Bugsy dates back to 1984. He had approached his friend Warren Beatty for a loan. Beatty had a different idea. If Toback wrote a screenplay for Beatty about Bugsy Siegel, Beatty would give Toback the money he needed as an advance. Toback loved the idea and thought he was the perfect choice to write the film.
I felt possessed in some strange way by Bugsy's spirit. I don't want to get too mystical because I'm not really, I don't believe these things literally, but I felt that from the time I first looked at photographs of Bugsy and then started reading about him, that I understood who he was, that I understood the kind of Jew that he was. A very strange mix of qualities went into Bugsy Siegel. He was from a lower middle class Jewish family with ambitions to raising itself. His brother became a well-known Beverly Hills doctor. You were supposed to be a good boy and get an education. Bugsy was extremely smart, liked by almost everybody, but was also homicidal. He had a tender streak, a well-mannered, courtly streak. He was sexually obsessed, but he killed without any compunction whatsoever. This mix in an American Jew struck me as fascinating and also, in some odd way that I probably shouldn't investigate too thoroughly, understandable.
How come it took 7 years to finish the screenplay?
Well, I was rightly suspicious that I was not going to be asked to direct this movie. And since my five most recent films I'd written and directed, and since I think of directing as a process which is simply an extension of the writing that I've done, I didn't really like the idea of finishing and then finding I wasn't going to be directing it. So I think I unconsciously fought against finishing it. Then finally, when a gun was put to my head, figuratively if not literally, by Beatty, which is to say that he heard that he knew that Fox was going to do some, you know, Joel Silver ripoff special on a, you know, like violent gangster movie with Bugsy Siegel as the main character. And basically what he said to me is either you're going to finish this script or give me this script or the movie's never going to get done because they'll do a Bugsy Siegel and whether it stinks or not, ours will never get made. So that spurred me on. I finished it and then a great collaboration, surprisingly enough, ensued.
How did you want Bugsy to be different from other gangster films?
Well, I never really saw it as a gangster film. I saw it as a film about a romantically yearning, overreaching, impatient, wildly complicated guy who happened to live the life of a gangster, more in the past than in the part of the movie I was concerned about. In other words, the Bugsy Siegel we know as a gangster really established himself up to the point the movie starts. Our movie starts, Bugsy starts, with Bugsy leaving New York for L.A., where he's going to take over the rackets in L.A., which in fact he does, and so there's that gangster's element in L.A., but essentially what he really wants to be is a star. And while he can't be a star on screen like his friend George Raft, he can and is a star off screen, and his true creation then becomes Las Vegas. He wants to build the city in the desert.
What were some of the places you went and people you hung out with to write the screenplay to really get in the spirit for this movie?
Well, on a certain level, the place I spent time with was in my own core of dementia, which is to say that I wrote the character from the inside out. I felt my way into Bugsy, saw what was in me that was in Bugsy, which I always try to do with a character, see the world from that character's point of view. Then for the specifics, I listened to all the FBI tapes to get a sense of his language. I read a great deal. I know Las Vegas inside out, although Las Vegas today is nothing like what Bugsy originally had in mind. I talked to loads of people that he'd known, so I sort of digested things along the way.
Where did you go in Vegas?
Well, I spent a lot of time at the in the Bugsy suite at the Flamingo, now called Flamingo Hilton. It's owned by Hilton Hotels. And suite 44,000 is the actually Bugsy suite there. It's the original building, which is now dwarfed by two 30-story glass towers. But his room exists pretty much the way it was then, his suite. So I spent a lot of time there and wrote a lot of the script there. And I would think of that building being what it was, Bugsy's building, and his suite being his suite, and at the same time looking out at this monstrosity, this vulgar display of garishness and madness and greed that the city has become.
You have been an inveterate gambler. I don't know if you're still gambling now, but did you end up gambling and losing a lot of money while writing the screenplay?
Let's put it this way, rather than going into specifics. Gambling is a, I believe, genetic obsession, compulsion, which never leaves anyone who has it any more than alcoholism does or drug addiction does, and I think it's just a question of behavioral eruptions, and I've had my share of them.
Seems to me there's something fundamentally self-destructive about someone who's a gambler like you, who's trying to not gamble as much, writing a screenplay about Bugsy Siegel, and then having to spend a lot of time in Vegas to do the research.
Well, I look at my work as the primary justification for hanging around. The one thing everybody knows from the day he's born is that he's going to die. And after a certain point, when you've experienced quite a bit and experimented, as I had at a rather early age, I would say by 24 or 25, I had done most of what my fantasy life had reached into. I think you need some kind of justification to say, I choose to live rather than to die. And for me, that justification is making movies. It's doing work that I consider worthwhile and interesting and exciting and ambitious, and then trying to execute it as well as I can. And if it leads me to the North Pole, it leads me to the North Pole. If I get in trouble as a result, I get in trouble as a result. But my goal is not to lead necessarily a life of the median. It's not to get comfortable and happy in any conventional sense. It's to be able somehow to reach beyond where I've been before and do something that will, I feel, justify my time on Earth.
If you're just joining us, my guest is James Toback. He wrote the screenplay for the new movie Bugsy. We're going to take a short break, then we'll talk some more. This is Fresh Air. James Toback is my guest, and in addition to writing the screenplay for Bugsy, he wrote and directed Fingers, The Pickup Artist, Love and Money, Exposed, and his most recent film that he directed was The Big Bang. You've written the screenplay for Bugsy as a story about a criminal who loves movies and in a way wants to be a movie star, and his good friend George Raft, played by Joe Mantegna, who's a movie star, but who's also connected with gangsters. What interests you in this connection between crime and film?
Well, film releases one from moral constraint in a way that no other art form does. It's the most expressionistic and irrational of the arts. And
that's certainly how you've used it.
Yes. And that's the kind of film that appeals to me. And I think that that sort of frees the imagination to run amok. And it's fun to let the imagination run amok when you don't, you know, to commit crimes on screen and not get arrested for them because you didn't do it in real life. What more can you ask?
So why are you're fascinated both by movies and by gangsters?
Well, I'm fascinated by crime more than gangsters. I'm fascinated by the idea that you do not allow other people to draw limits and lines around your behavior. That is to say, who are these people who tell you what is right and wrong? Well, it's obvious on the practical level. It's society that gets together, appoints certain people, or if it's a monarchy, it's done that way. And then you can't do this, you can do that, you'll go to jail if you do that. That's all rather simple on that level. But finally, who are they? They're just other human beings. Why do they have the capacity to tell you what is right or wrong in your life? Why don't you have the ability yourself to decide? And I think that that writing about characters who live that way or who think that way is fundamentally more interesting to me than writing about characters who pretty much take for granted, as most people do, that you behave the way the law, that is to say, other people tell you to behave.
Now, you went to ethical culture school. I'm not even sure what that is, but it certainly doesn't sound like the kind of background you should have come out of to feel the way you do about crime and perversity.
Well, ethical culturism is a kind of rational, agnostic movement that broke away from Reform Judaism at the turn of the century. And, you know, I mean, I believe in all kinds of ethical precepts, and I think I practice them. I have my own ethical code, and it actually is not all that different from the ethical code that it suffuses the ethical culture movement. I just think that to try to deny the endless complexities of human nature is, A, reductive and much less interesting, and B, in the long run, an invitation to catastrophe, because self-knowledge, I think, always helps to get you on the right track. And self-deception, which is to say to view oneself and other people with a chimerically evasive, sugar-coated notion, is does no one any good.
So when you were going to ethical culture school, was that about the same time that you started gambling also and hanging out at places that
No, I yeah. started I went to Harvard was what opened the door for me. I mean I was leading a kind of curious other life when I was at ethical culture. I had friends who were not of that world, but Harvard was the one where the floodgates were open, because Boston and Cambridge, that and in the middle 60s, was a kind of laboratory at the time for experimentation. You had the whole drug movement, counterculture. You had a kind of violent black world there. You had a gambling world. You had the dynamic of romantic and sexual experimentation. You had an academic world. You had a lot of foreign students, whom I got to, Latin American students, sons of dictators and stuff, socialists, communists. It was a terrific mix. And in those 3 years, I felt as if I were experiencing everything that was going on in the world.
And that's how you started gambling when you were at Harvard?
Gambling, I started right around that time. But gambling, has had a kind of strange. It sort of comes and goes. It's in my life. It's out of my life. It's in. It's out. I don't learn anything from it anymore, which is why it would be a good thing never to do it again. And I am actually at a point now where I don't even like to say this, because until have been a couple of years when I haven't done it, but I feel I sort of purged it from my system now, and that there's no real point in doing it anymore, and that I therefore won't. But there's a point at which it was a learning experience for me too, and I got a lot from it psychologically and sociologically. That point is past. There's nothing new for me to learn.
So what did you get out of gambling when you were younger?
I got apart from the sociological observations, seeing, you know, what people behaved like under circumstances of stress and danger and risk and compulsion and obsession, I got an understanding of my own flirtations with extinction, because after all, gambling is really a kind of mini version, a kind of microcosmic version of a life and death exchange. You basically say, I'm either dead or I'm alive. I'm going to shoot my wad. I'm buried. I'm alive. They use this language. It's part of a gambler's lingo. You know, you say, I'm alive in the daily double, or I'm dead, or I'm history. It's filled with life and death feelings. You end up accepting your own mortality in a strange way if you gamble for a while in an intense atmosphere. It forces you into these feelings of total loss and devastation. Now, obviously, life itself provides those, and I don't think that anyone's going to be immune from it, but gambling is a kind of heightened, condensed, artificial way of giving you that sort of gruesome education in the suddenness of obliteration.
Did you ever end up owing money to loan sharks, for instance, and end up not being able to just observe other people and gamble but remain on the sidelines, but rather be kind of drawn into the action because you owed money? I guess I'm asking if you were ever beaten up or threatened in a way that physically involved you beyond what you wanted.
No, I've always done it I've always known how to handle myself in whatever area I've gotten into, and I've been very, very careful to do. The real illegality has nothing to do with the real danger of gambling. The real danger of gambling is that you will lose not just what you do have, but what you don't have. And that's why this whole Bugsian dream in Las Vegas now is so fascinating, because what Bugsy really was after was a kind of city in the desert, a kind of wild creation. And what Las Vegas has become is a place that people go to, basically. Forget the middle American convention image that they like to project. What they really have created is a place where ordinary people who are not basically addicted, who have not yet fallen off the cliff, go and do fall off the cliff. I don't mean all of them. I don't even mean most of them. But let's say the 10%, and I'm guessing at the figure, maybe it's more, maybe it's less, but a considerable number of people come to Las Vegas thinking they're going to have fun, to do this, to do that, and basically they get wiped out. They lose everything they have. Their entire lives are changed in some fundamental way. There's no other city in America that provides this service, and I use the word ironically, obviously. And that's really, as I say, gambling is that's the fascination of it. It's a kind of laboratory for psychic extremes. You're forced into, even if you're perfectly legitimate and legal, you sit at a blackjack table for 4 hours and everything you worked for 30 years is gone.
Did you see a lot of that?
I've seen it over and over and over again. I've seen major entertainers, people who are in the public eye, reduced to begging on their knees and sobbing because they want just one more chance, one more bit of credit so that they can continue to try to win back what they've lost. People who are beyond where they're even going to be able to entertain for free, where they've said, just give me another credit. I'll sing for another 2 weeks. I'll sing for this. You already have to do that. Well, I'll do it next year. I mean, the depths of desperation. But Las Vegas is the only city where people come, little do they know, I think, in many, many cases, to be reduced to nothingness.
Earlier you were talking about your interest in Jewish criminals. As someone who is Jewish, what did it mean to you to find that there was a sector of American crime that was Jewish? You know, a lot of people look for all kinds of things to affirm their heritage and affirm their roots. You wouldn't think that finding gangsters would be the thing that did it, but what did that do for you?
Well, I find it. I think it makes it much more interesting. It makes the Jewish experience in America much more rich and complex. And there is a certain kind of Jew who's very embarrassed about this sort of stuff, and I find that embarrassing. I find the embarrassment embarrassing. We did a documentary for Showtime on the making of Bugsy, and we were going to shoot in the cemetery, the Jewish cemetery where Bugsy's buried in L.A., and the rabbi there would not let us shoot there because he's embarrassed to have Bugsy buried there and doesn't want anyone to know that this criminal, this killer, is buried in this Jewish cemetery. To me, that's utterly insane. It's, you know, the sort of is it good for the Jews defensive mentality that in the long run, I just think breeds more anti-Semitism, not less. That is to say, when you go in saying, we should be on our best behavior because we're in an alien land filled with anti-Semites and they're all going to get us unless we cower in a corner and obey all the rules and act accordingly. We cannot break the law because we're lucky to be here and other people can break it, but we can't. To me, full citizenship comes when you're ready to admit to the full diversity and colors of your nature and of your history and of your past.
I think it's fair to say that in Hollywood you're known as an eccentric. How does the success of Bugsy affect your profile in Hollywood?
Well, I think that, you know, anyone who's been at all out of the mainstream in his behavior and gotten away with certain things. I mean, I've been able to make movie after movie, and some people have loved them, some have hated them, but I've gotten them made, I've gotten them done the way I've wanted to do them. You have people lying in wait for you, you know. There are people who want to see you fail, who are dying to see you fail, and I think this makes that a bitterer pill for them, for enemies. It means to friends that they're happy to see that I've succeeded in a way that they recognize more as success, and that's nice. I mean, it's nice that I have, you know, the to see, because there have been loads and loads of calls and people who care about you. That's very nice. For practical reasons, it's nice because I think it'll make the next movie that much easier to set up. The way I look at it is, and it's true of reviews too, it's great to get beautifully written reviews, which we've had a lot of that were raves and all that, but it's all finally practical. Does this stuff help you to do your next movie or not? And in this case, I think it probably does. So that's all to the good, because making a movie is not like writing a novel. You need all this money all the time to do it, and it's a struggle.
James Toback, I want to thank you very much for talking with us.
Thank you.
My guest has been James Toback, and he wrote the screenplay for Bugsy. He also wrote the screenplay for The Gambler and wrote and directed Fingers, The Pickup Artist, and Love and Money. I'm Terry Gross, and this is Fresh Air.